Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When you hear a story about Google's mapping vehicles, combing neighborhoods, monitoring homes, and collecting email from wireless web connections, albeit unintentionally, does it raise concerns about your privacy? Enough to want a new government watchdog? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as online savings account and money market account. Learn more at AllyBank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We made it to Friday, November 12th, and there was word today the White House is preparing to beef up internet privacy laws, including creation of an online watchdog to guard your security on the web. This news comes amid mounting privacy complaints ranging from Facebook's collection and sharing of personal data to Google's Street View mapping vehicles capturing business and personal Wi-Fi connections. There are growing calls for legislation, and both the Commerce Department and Federal Trade Commission are preparing recommendations on the subject. From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn joins us with more on this now. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you, Bob?
Good, thanks. I confess I'm one of those who can't be bothered and click right past all that legal privacy mumbo-jumbo, figuring what's the worst that can happen? They'll use my email to send me some sales pitches. But you say it goes way beyond that. What kind of privacy concerns are we talking about? What's the bleeding edge of what we need to worry about?
Well, you know, it's pretty old news now that e-commerce sites track you. And if folks have been listening to this show, at least they know that marketers can use the cell phone in your pocket to follow you around. But the technology just keeps making leaps forward. Have you checked out Microsoft's game console for the Xbox Kinect?
Yeah, I have. It's getting some buzz.
Yeah. And basically, it tracks you so you can play video games without a remote control. And it also uses facial recognition software to know who's playing the game. Well, executives at Microsoft say they could use that same facial recognition software to actually target ads, not just at the person playing the game, but anyone sitting in the living room in front of those cameras. So think about that for a second. This game is a huge hit, or the system is a hit. They expect to ship 5 million units by the end of the year. So, you know, millions of Americans are going to have cameras in their living room that can track them and know who they are.
And this is all happening now, so what are policymakers doing to get ahead of the curve, and are privacy advocates satisfied?
Well, you know, there's news today that the Commerce Department and the White House will create a high-level privacy watchdog. And that person would negotiate with governments overseas about privacy and also ride herd on the issue in the administration. But many privacy advocates are worried about this proposal. See, the Commerce Department is pushing a system of beefed-up self-regulation for the industry. And guys like Jeff Chester at the Center for Digital Democracy say that's not enough. What he wants is kind of a consumer bill of rights for online privacy. Here's how he put it.
Consumer protection in the digital age means that a consumer knows what information is being collected about them, how that information is being used, and more critically, can control how that information is being used.
The FTC is reportedly considering a do not track list that would let Americans opt out of sharing personal information online.
And what's the industry's take on that?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, they hate it. I mean, personal information and using personal information in marketing is central to the business model of some of the most successful companies in America right now. I mean, this is what Google does. This is what Facebook does. Increasingly, it's what Apple and Microsoft do. So they're lobbying hard against this proposal and are really more supportive of a competing privacy proposal being pushed by the Commerce Department that would allow the industry to self-regulate.
Marketplace's Steve Henn on technology. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Wall Street ended the week in a surly mood. Details when we do the numbers. We've been keeping you updated on proposals to reform the nation's tax code, ideas from the co-directors of the President's Debt Commission. but we've yet to check out the corporate tax proposals. Republican Alan Simpson and Democrat Erskine Bowles recommend reducing the nation's corporate tax rate from 35% to 26%. Company executives frequently complain the current tax rate is the highest in the world. Is it really? Marketplace's John Dimsdale takes a look.
Among the industrialized countries, only Japan's corporate tax rate is higher than the U.S. But Bob McIntyre with Citizens for Tax Justice says U.S. corporations can reduce that hit by close to a third, thanks to a long list of tax breaks.
When you add in all the loopholes that we have that the other countries don't have, we're down near the bottom in corporate taxes as a share of the GDP. Only three countries in the industrialized world are lower than we are.
Those deductions include depreciation on equipment, tax breaks for investments in research and development, and companies don't pay taxes on the appreciation of inventory sitting on factory shelves. The proposal from the directors of the Presidential Deficit Commission would lower the corporate tax rate by nearly 30% in return for doing away with most corporate tax deductions. But McIntyre says that doesn't raise any more tax revenue from companies.
This is supposed to be the Deficit Reduction Commission. And if they close a lot of corporate loopholes, they'll then give all the money back to the corporations, they haven't done anything about the deficit.
But beyond the loopholes, some companies avoid paying the tax rate in other ways. For example, this month, Bloomberg reported how Google sliced its tax rate to around 22% last year. They did it through legal accounting maneuvers to transfer most foreign income to Bermuda, where there's no corporate income tax. So some experts say U.S. corporations have done all right. But others say they're just leveling the playing field with other countries that have lower corporate tax rates. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A correction to our first summary of the deficit panel's plan the other day. We incorrectly described its proposal for eliminating the home mortgage interest deduction. Most homeowners would actually keep it, but it would be eliminated for mortgages on second loans, for home equity loans, and for mortgages over $500,000. The U.S. Postal Service delivered bad news today. It announced it lost $8.5 billion in the last fiscal year, more than double what it lost the year before, and it says without federal help, it'll go broke by the end of next fiscal year. But don't expect your local mail delivery to disappear yet. Help just might come in the form of a greeting card, or actually lots of them, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The Postal Service has been fighting a losing battle with online communication. Till now, it's had goofy ads, special deals, goofy ads with special deals.
Plus, I can pick it up for free.
Perfect, because we have to get that out of this house.
Come on, it's not that big. Oh, yeah, that's got to go.
So now it has a new plan. The post office may soon allow greeting card companies to sell pre-stamped envelopes with their cards. Marissa Gluck of Radar Research says in doing so, the post office is tapping into a very basic human tendency.
I think people are really busy around the holiday time, so being able to eliminate one extra trip to the post office is really appealing.
Each pre-stamped envelope could add about 48 cents to the cost of the card. That's 4 pennies more than the usual stamp. John Gorville is a marketing professor at Harvard Business School.
I do think there'll be that sticker shock, though.
If you buy a box of 20 stamped cards, it's going to cost you $9.60 more than that box of unstamped cards nearby. The post office predicts this could bring in $10 to $20 million in the first year. But not this year. The post office says it'll roll out the program in February. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Like millions of employees across the nation around this time of year, we at Marketplace got the talk this week. This is when workers sign up for health insurance plans. We just found out our premiums are going up pretty significantly. And it's not just us. The National Business Group on Health, a body that represents big employers, estimates premiums for company-paid plans will rise by roughly 9% this year. But wait a minute. Didn't we just pass a huge health care reform bill that was supposed to help people afford health care coverage? We sent card-carrying health insurance customer Stacey Vanek-Smith to check it out.
Even doctors are paying more for health insurance. David Terrigan is a neurologist in Silver Springs, Maryland. Last year, his premiums rose 35%. And this year?
Well, our premiums have gone up about 13.5%. But the real kicker is that the coverage levels have dramatically dropped.
Meaning more out-of-pocket costs. Health insurance premiums have more than doubled in the last decade. Industry analyst Robert Leshefsky says much of the increase has to do with costly new treatments and overhead. And he says the bad economy is making things worse.
In poor economic times, you tend to have the sicker people keep their coverage and the healthy people drop the coverage. And as a result, you tend to get higher rate increases.
Leshefsky says cost-conscious employers are foisting more of that burden onto employees. But wasn't health care reform supposed to lower our costs?
Most of the fixes aren't in place yet.
That's Alan Garber, director of the Center for Health Policy at Stanford. He says the parts of health care reform that could help push premiums down don't go into effect until 2014, like the individual mandate, which requires everyone to buy health insurance.
The reason for this provision is to make sure healthy people purchase health insurance so that when you figure out the premium for a group of insured people, it can be relatively low.
That's for so-called healthcare exchanges, where people will be able to shop for health insurance in 2014. Until then, you can probably add rising health insurance premiums to that old saying about death and taxes. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
By the way, we've got a comprehensive look at some of the changes in store for healthcare at marketplace.org. Click on the Consumer's Guide to Healthcare. General Motors may be about to become the biggest U.S. automaker partly owned by the Chinese. The U.S. government is preparing to unload much of its share of the company, with an initial public offering of GM stock reportedly set for next week. Today, the New York Times reports China's biggest automaker is close to finalizing a plan to buy a stake in GM. The paper cites people familiar with the discussions. This week has been all about the global markets. The G20 summit wrapped up today, just as the Fed's quantitative easing plan begins to roll out, and China moves to cut back inflation. As we always do on Friday, we're kicking off our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, this time with Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
The G20 summit is over, and in the end, the U.S. didn't make a lot of progress on trying to bring concerted pressure on China to raise the value of its currency. So where does that leave us now? Sudeep?
Well, we obviously have an impasse, and you're probably going to have to see more actual movement in these economies as a result of these changes in the currency we've seen over the last couple of months. That means just more economic data to actually put pressure on the players to do something. But right now, it's very clear that you have every government really talking their book here at the table when you're dealing with currencies, and it's probably not going to back off from that point.
One of the other things left undone, President Obama is heading home from South Korea, and we still don't have a trade agreement with the government in Seoul. What's the problem? Why can't we seem to nail this down, Lee?
Well, it's a couple things. I mean, first of all, Obama's dealing with a new Congress and probably didn't want to bring home a deal that would be rejected. Auto imports are a big sticking point, with standards being very different in South Korea than here. But, I do think a lot of this was just the whole planned summit and discussion was overshadowed by a lot of the pushback that Obama was getting from our monetary policy.
And Bob, it's really interesting here to see a centerpiece of the Obama economic agenda, increasing exports, actually falling apart in part over beef. And it's become obviously an emotional issue for people when you start talking about mad cow disease, even though it seems like a distant memory for us. But it kind of shows how wherever you are, the trade tensions at home breaks down a lot on both emotional and the substantive. Obviously, with the auto industry, we've gone through so much pain with our own auto industry in the U.S. that it's not surprising that this would also be a major sticking point.
So if we can't persuade the foreign trading partners to do what we want, maybe we can boost our exports with this so-called quantitative easing plan from the Federal Reserve, or can we? It's coming under fire even within the central bank. Given this dissent within the ranks, Lee, how long will they stick with it, realistically speaking?
Well, you know, this dissent has been, I think that's been one of the biggest stories of this week. I mean, it's coming from everywhere. It's coming from inside the Fed. It's coming from Greenspan. You know, it wasn't so long ago that a move like this was heralded. And I think that's just the problem. You know, this quantitative easing is a lot easier to sell when we're on the brink. And we really aren't right now, which is a good thing.
It is actually really good to see the Fed openly debating something like this that didn't always happen in the past. We didn't have the same kind of public debate about low interest rates earlier in the decade, which obviously had an impact on where we are today. It is perfectly valid to say that a move like what the Fed did creates some risk. Monetary policy always does. But there are obviously other things that fueled the housing boom other than low rates. And the question you have to ask yourself is, what would you do in Ben Bernanke's shoes when you have a tool that might do something, even something very little, to at least address part of the problem?
Let's take a quick look at the domestic situation. Last but certainly not least, jobs. Any light at the end of the tunnel there, Sadiq?
Most people would actually be surprised to hear that in the private sector, the U.S. has created 1 million jobs in the last year. It's the fact. So we're seeing a recovery. It's just very slow. Even if you look at the most bullish, realistic scenario, though, it's going to take 4 or 5 years to get back to where we were before the recession, and probably closer to a decade if you're not that bullish.
And the one thing to keep in mind about that is that, you know, some of the arguments for not using monetary policy is that, you know, cut the deficit, the private sector will do the hiring. And one of the things we're seeing is that the private sector is not doing the hiring, and we don't know when they're going to start doing the hiring in full. Companies have a lot of cash, earnings are strong, and they are being incredibly, incredibly, incredibly cautious. And that's going to be with us for quite some time.
On the right track, still trying to get the engine started. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Sadiq Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Coming up.
What was neat about having a pop-up shop at Christmas was that I could still be tabletop but have, you know, crystal candlesticks and interesting things that people could walk out the door with.
Why pop-up shops aren't just a seasonal trend. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell yet again, down 90 points or 0.8% to close at 11,192. The NASDAQ ticked down 37 points. That's almost 1.5% to end the day at 2518. The S&P 500 dropped 14 points, 0.1% to finish at 1199. For the week, the Dow and the S&P 500 each fell 2.2%. The NASDAQ powered down 2.4%. Talk of an interest rate hike in China concerned investors around the world, and it was particularly bad news for metal suppliers. Aluminum producer Alcoa sheared off 2.3%. Copper and gold supplier Freeport-McMoRan lost 3.75%. Today was the first day of the government's bond buying spree, but bond prices fell, which isn't what the Fed wanted. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.79%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for the month of October. The Society of Government Economists begins its annual meeting at George Washington University. And a group project. Monday is America Recycles Day. Party! Then get those bottles in the bin. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. As we mentioned a moment ago, the G20 summit ended today. World leaders of the biggest global economies agreed on various steps, all with the aim of improving economic stability. They were short on specifics, though. As with many of these international summits, the measures don't come with a how-to. It's up to each country to spell out their own way of getting there. And commentator Michael Perino says reforms often fall flat because of who's in power.
On June 6, 1934, Franklin Roosevelt signed the Securities Exchange Act into law. The bill created the Securities and Exchange Commission and, for the first time, regulated the country's stock markets. When he finished, the president handed one of the ceremonial pens to Ferdinand Pecora. His name might not ring any bells, but it should. He led a gripping investigation of Wall Street wrongdoing. Pecora blazed the path for reform. But he knew its limitations. Roosevelt asked Ferd, "What kind of law will it be?" Pecora responded, "It will be a good or a bad bill, depending upon the men who administer it." He might well have added, "Let's see how the midterms go." The parallels between the Exchange Act and the recently passed Dodd-Frank law couldn't be clearer. Then, as now, there was a popular outcry to rein in the freewheeling banking industry. Both times, financiers pulled out all stops to defeat reform. Both times, Congress punted on many of the hardest questions. The main difference lies in the election outcomes. The Democratic victory in 1934 was a resounding vote of approval for the New Deal. The new agency wrote a strong and fair set of regulations. It was a vigilant cop on the beat until declining resources and indifferent administrations sapped its strength. Today, popular outrage over Wall Street excesses remains high. Yet resurgent Republicans have vowed to put Dodd-Frank and the new regulations implementing it under the microscope. The rhetoric is all about fostering economic recovery and making America's banks globally competitive. But the real goal seems to be eviscerating reform before it's had a chance to succeed. Republican control of the House will likely mean shrinking budgets for financial regulators. They simply may not have enough resources to adequately police the marketplace. Pecora wouldn't be surprised. Just a few years after his path-breaking investigation, he warned that if we didn't maintain our vigilance, Wall Street might be easy to regulate, but hard to control.
Michael Perino is the author of the new book, The Hellhound of Wall Street. Got a comment? Send them our way. Write to us at marketplace.org. Talk about your niche marketing. You may have noticed that certain stores can be here today and gone tomorrow. Pop-up stores, as retailers call them, aren't just for Halloween costumes or Christmas decor. In this season of uncertain sales figures, all sorts of companies have zoomed in on temporary stores, hoping to connect with customers in just the right place at just the right moment. Don't blink or you might miss them, but as Janet Babin reports, the pop-up concept may be here to stay.
Target pioneered the pop-up store as a marketing event, but it's become a marketing strategy. This spring, its Liberty of London collection debuted at a temporary space in New York.
We had thousands upon thousands of fresh-cut flowers filling the space, so it was very fragrant.
That's Target spokesman Joshua Thomas.
So you were really immersed in the entire collection. It's almost as if you walked into the ad campaign.
The collection sold out before the Target pop-up store was scheduled to close. Now, lots of big chains are working pop-up stores. 25 Borders will pop up this holiday season. Toys R Us will open up 600 Express stores and hire thousands of seasonal workers. Deb Purcell, with Pitney Bowes Business Insight, says it's all about convenience, grabbing shoppers wherever they are.
It's really, I think, about capturing the consumer's first impulse to make a purchase and prevent those dollars from going to competition.
For some retailers, pop-ups are a chance to test the waters, to see if they can make it in the bricks-and-mortar world. E-tailer Christina Norsig sells luxury china and glassware at etabletop.com, not the kind of stuff people buy on impulse. So last year, she took a chance on a physical space in New York.
what was neat about having a pop-up shop at Christmas was that I could still be tabletop but have, you know, crystal candlesticks and interesting things that people could walk out the door with.
There will be no tabletop pop-up this year, but Norsig's store spawned a new business, popupinsider.com. Her firm matches retailers searching for short-term space with willing landlords.
It's what I call bricks, clicks, and quicks. We have our brick-and-mortar stores, we have our internet business, and now we have quicks, meaning temporary real estate, and I see it as a trend that's here to stay.
The pop-up concept has even spread to brands that don't normally have stores. Brides Magazine just opened up a temporary space where brides can taste cake, look at dresses, and brush up on wedding etiquette. Procter & Gamble rented a store for 10 days on New York's 57th Street.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Welcome to PMG Brunstable.
The store gave people a chance to try out P&G products like Olay Skin Creams and Clairol's Nice and Easy. Customer Joyce Hom took advantage of the free style session to glam up her black hair with an auburn sheen.
I love it. It's just the color, the shine. It's like, it's so nice. It's like, I wish I had some place to go to tonight to show it off.
All the primping and free products made customers giddy. Pop-up stores may be temporary, but to customers, they have to feel like regular stores, or it could hurt a brand's image. Deb Purcell with Pitney Bowes says you don't want to let customers down.
It could actually backfire on them if the store is being staffed with temporary help or if the merchandise is not in stock that the customer needs.
If they avoid those pitfalls, Purcell says pop-up shops could boost sales figures for retailers, cut lines for customers, and just maybe a few of those short-term leases will turn into permanent tenants. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, it's on like Donkey Kong. If you should find yourself tempted to use that pop culture reference, you just might need to get permission from Nintendo next time. According to the Urban Dictionary, it's on like Donkey Kong means to compete at a high level. Doesn't everybody know that? No matter that the phrase has been heard in music and movies for years, Nintendo is just now claiming ownership. CNN reports the company that owns the popular Donkey Kong franchise has filed its request with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 90 points, or 0.8%. The NASDAQ ticked down 37 points. That's 1.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 14 points, 1.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, if you have kids, you know it's not easy teaching them how to manage money. But maybe it'll be easier if you start real, real early.
Everybody say saving.
Saving.
Money.
Money.
Helps.
Helps.
Us.
Us.
A kindergarten class on personal finance. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.